Access number 30402, Mr. Ken Austin, Real 7. Now, so that was the New Zealanders. You said you got on well with the Maoris.
Yeah.
In what way? What was so good about
it? Well, they've got an attitude of life that it's hard to describe, but you can sit in their rugby and their way they play, and that's how they were. They were the type of person that get on with anybody. They were always good fun, always had a laugh and a joke with you, you know. And they seem to be a nice type of people, you know.
Anything much happen other than this ammunition problem while you were with them?
No, that was the only problem they had, because they were supplied wasn't up-to-date equipment, whether it was from Australia, from New Zealand, or whether it was from the Americans, or whoever supplied the ammo, I don't know. But that was their problem. But when they did work, and they sent these six-inch mortars over, they went, you know, and you could see the blooming explosion over the other side.
Now, so what next then?
Came back to the camp again, done the general normal things, and then the next time I went out, it was to the Korean infantry.
South Korean infantry.
South Korean infantry, yeah. But to get to them, you had to go along a road, and then you went aside, the wrong side of a mountain, more facing the enemy than behind it. So they built an Hessian barricade along.
What, Hessian? What do you mean?
Like a sacking stuff.
Just so not so much a barricade, just so that they couldn't see.
So you couldn't see, and it was a fair length, right, to the face of this, to get to these Koreans. Now, when you get to the bottom, at the start of it, there's military police. It's either American or British. Now, when you get there, the British, somebody stirred the dust up, and then you've got incoming mail, the British would stay there. But if somebody stirred it up and the Americans were there, down the side of the road was a hole dug with a shelter. If you wouldn't find the Americans there, they'd be down in the hole. But their purpose there was to tell you that you could... Once you got there, it was very dusty, don't light or something. You had to drive very slowly. You didn't disturb the dust, because the North Koreans and the Chinese would see you, or see the dust, and they'd lob a few over. So to go through there, you had to go really slow, you know. And me, with a dingo armoured car, I sort of crept very gently through there, so I got to the other side. And when I had to come back, I'd done the same coming back the other way. Anyway, I get to this Korean base, introduced myself. Oh, the thing was, the OP, the operation place, was up on a hill, on a mound, so you had to walk up some steps.
That was your OP?
No, that was the Koreans.
Right, sorry.
Right? So you get parked at the bottom, and I walked up, went through the bunker door sort of thing to introduce myself, and got in there, see this officer and that, and spoke to me in quite good English, and okay, so, oh, by the way, how did you get in there? You know, with a serious look on his face, and I said, oh, I just walked up and walked in. He said, wasn't you challenged? I said, no, I said, nobody out there to challenge me. Just a moment, he said, and he sent me over to another chap, and he walked out, and I heard a pistol shot, and came back in, and he said to this other officer in Korean, taken care of, sort of thing, I suppose, and the bloke who's supposed to be on guard or that, they just shot him. That was that. That was their attitude, because they couldn't trust who was who and who wasn't, sort of thing, you know. And then that stayed there, same sort of thing, you know, while if they needed help.
How did you get on with them?
Well, couldn't say you got on a lot because most of them were Koreans at the time. And they only spoke Korean, only a few officers that could speak English, sort of thing. And a lot of the Korean soldiers there, the infantry people, were just people from their own country, farm labourers and stuff like that, were sort of conscripted into the army. So then I went back to the camp again. Then I've sent
anything happened money with else happened with the Soviets?
Nothing really exciting, that sort of thing. But then I went back, and then there was a message come through that the American ambulances and that were being attacked by Koreans, North Koreans and Chinese, who were sneaking through our lines at night and shooting up the ambulances and that. So then, for a while, I used to do, whatever, different people, we used to do ambushing. We used to go out at night and hide in bushes and that on these runs, roughly where the ambulance was going, and wait for the Chinese or the North Koreans to come through the lines, and then we used to attack them before they attacked the ambulances. So that went on for a while, you know.
So how would you set up an ambush position?
Yeah.
Well, how would you do it?
Well, you buried yourself or cut a load of bushes and stuff down and stuck them around your armoured car. Well, there used to be two of us in the armoured car. One had a Bren gun one side and the other one had a Browning 300 the other side. So I think you just sit and watch. And any movement during the night, that was it. You know, you attacked it or shot at it or stuff like that. Well, one night we was on parade, on the ambush stuff, and across the paddy fields, there was a moment. I said to the chap beside, I said, there's a movement creeping across the hills. So he turned around and I said, because other night you look at something, and if you see it move, you have to look away. You can't look at it, and then you ask somebody else who's with you to look and see if they see a movement. And then you go back again and look and see that where you marked it in your mind, it's moved from that part to another part. Then you know that there's just something. Anyway, it was this movement, and I said to my mate, I said, I think I put a burst over them. And just as I was going to pull the trigger, the chap, whoever it was, stood up. And I thought, well, it wouldn't be the enemy if they're going to stand up. They're going to still creep along. And I shouted out, and it was a drunken Australian trying to find his way back to his regiment. But I nearly give him a burst of ammo, sort of thing, but we got him back. But a couple of times we did have an encounter with some of them, you know, so we did open up.
So what happened? What would an encounter be like?
Well, you just opened up fire, and then it ceased off. You waited a while, you went to see what damage, who was shot, and if anybody must have got back, run back, you know, because after time in the dark you can't always see, especially in the like paddy fields and stuff like that, you can't always see what was going on.
And did you ever hit anyone? Or,
well, you, know,
you just don't know.
You don't know. You can't say, oh, well, that was so. You just fired the gun, and if anybody got hit, whether you done it or when the bloke on the other side done it with his, you don't know. You don't go down and inspect the bullet wound. You make sure there's some.
Did they return fire?
Oh, yeah. But the thing was, being in an armoured car, it just sat there.
Now, anything else you're doing?
Well, not at that moment. I've got to then wait to the next lot, you know. Can you kill it off?
Anything else you were on?
Yeah, well, then I get back to camp again, and then I go to the Americans. Right, so I'm parked up along with the American infantry, and they had a padre, a sort of chap, you know, comes along and sees speaks to me and he says, oh, well, it's your son's, yeah, yeah. I've got a wireless back, you know, helped him. And I could hear gunshot shooting, you know, and I thought, I said to him, anything happening, you know, you've been attacked on your, you're attacking on your front up the, so he says, oh, no, 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 he says, it happened to be the regiment of the Texas Rangers. So he said, no, they're having a shootout over on the side of the hill. So I said, shoot, so he said, what's that? Oh, he said, they shoot targets and see who's the best shot. So he says, you know, go down if you like and have a look. So I goes down and they've got these 5-gallon petrol tanks with the diamond thing on it as their targets. So what they do, they take in, but they're using Colt 44s because that was their armament there. So they would fire at the target, who it got the diamond, then they move back so far and then they fired again and who's got it. So I was talking to the sergeant bloke who was in charge down there about it, so he said, yeah, he said, wanna go? Well, I found out that our 38 pistols used to take their carbine ammunition. It used to be the same. So I said, all right, I'll join him. Well, when you have your pistol, you used to do pistol training and you used to get your hand like that. And
out front.
Gradually bend it up to it, tighten all your fingers, and then gradually pull yourself back. And that makes your arm so that when you held the pistol, you kept it straight. I haven't done that for years. Oh, that was me own bloody fingers. Anyway, I go to join him, gets me 38 out. Starts with the first line of the new blokes that was coming in. So we fire, it's the target spot on. Go back a bit, I think two of them dropped out. Goes back with the next lot, fired again. In the end, I'm the only one. But the furthest back, still hitting a target. One that I say. Go through with the winners the last couple of, you know, so do the same again. Still come back, I'm still the furthest back. So they made me a honorary sheriff of Texas. And having the name Austin, most people used to call me Tex Austin because that was the capital of Texas. So I was made an honorary sheriff of Texas by the American Texas Rangers because I outshot their own blokes.
Sounds like you got on well with them.
I got on well, you mixed with them. I used to argue a lot with them, you know, because I used to say to them, America's a beautiful country, but it's spoilt by the people that live in it. And they used to do their nut, you know. But I mean, so that's how I felt. I mean, say some of the stupid things they used to do and get involved. I mean, say we had a hill out there, I think, I forget the name of it. Anyway, it was a good observation hill. So we used to have it, then the Chinese will have it, then we'll take it again. And then so they used to send different lots up there to take it. Now, the British used to send a squad, say about of 10 blokes to take the hill, and they used to take it and hold it for a couple of days. And but the Americans used to send a massive lot of squad, a troop of say 40, 50, 60 men, and they lose a lot. So their attitude was they chuck stuff life away, you know, by not doing it in a way where if you'd done it with less men, more skilled, you would save men, save lives. But their attitude is like to everything. They abuse things. They abuse material. They abuse, and that was their attitude, you know. Oh, yeah, you've got a nice little car in England, but in America, we've got one that big.
Quite as big.
So that's more petrol, more metal used, And that, to me, is abusing the supply of the world's materials. And that's what I used to say to them, you've got a beautiful country, America, it's built by the people that live in it. And they used to, some of the intelligent ones used to sort of agree with you, sort of thing, but the other ones, you know.
Anything happened while you were with them? Was it an active?
Well, they did have a little barney with the Koreans, North Koreans, you know, and the Chinese. Had a bit of shell fire and a sort of not a major attack, but a mild attack, trying to test their front. But they came off all right. They held their own. So.
Did you have to bring support fire down for them?
Well, nothing heavy. They had a light mortar support from the back of their line, you know. But that was. But the other funny thing about all along the line where I went to different places, they used to have markers that you had to put that where your line was. But there were so many dodgy attacks by the American Air Force that they used to put the markers the other way round. Because they thought if they put them that way round, they wouldn't get bombed by their own bloody Air Force. So a lot of different mobs along the front used to be like that, you know. That was their attitude to the gunno attacks by American Air Force. And I've seen some stupid things done by them. It's unbelievable, you know, that they bomb and attack things that they don't seem to coordinate with their back, you know, people behind them. But that's war, even going on now, isn't it, in Iraq. So it's not changed. It's not that I'm saying something that's different. You understand what I mean? I'm not running them down because it still happens.
Anything else about your time with them?
Well, I found, you know, they were quite easygoing. In fact, to my way of thinking, life was too easygoing. And I found that a lot of the lower ranks or the actual men on the front wasn't given enough information of what they were doing. You know, where the British or maybe the Australians, they get around, okay, this is what we've got to do. This is what's going to happen. So everybody knows. But the Americans didn't seem to be that way. They say, okay, that squad, say 25, 30 men, forward. That's our play. That's what we've got to get. But that's all they were told. You know, where the British, Australians, or other countries, you were informed what to do if anything goes wrong, what would be the best, and all this caper, you know, but to be more careful. To do the job, but be careful. And that was the way I see it personally, you know, the different armies, whether it's just one of those things or not. But to me, that's how it looked like to me. But that was the army.
So then back to you?
Back to normal things, back behind. And then gradually it got a bit easier. We weren't attacked too much. Then we had a terrible floods on the MGM, the water, the rain.
Now tell me about that, because I've not heard much about them.
Well, let me see. What can I describe the Ive? So you went down the two banks to the river at the bottom. Right? Now, they were high. Not like shallow river things like in England, they were high like the hillside. But when they had the rains and the monsoons, that type of stuff, whether it's our side or the North Korean side, it used to come down and it used to fill right up to the top, the rivers. And then if you look down, you see bodies and stuff where somewhere else up the place was fighting near the river, floating down in the water, that type of thing. So all your pontoon bridges and that, that you had down below were floating, but they were no good because they wasn't tied. They were tied like you're down here. So you got two big banks and the river's normally down. So they come down the road and then the pontoon's across and it's fixed to the ground. Stage of when the water came right up, the pontoons was under the water because they were chained down, they couldn't float to the top. So therefore, unless you had those that were loose, so that's why the Americans built a proper bridge up high across.
So that was the flooding. Any other effects of the flooding? What was it like in your camp?
Well, it was very muddy and sloshy. I mean, see, all your food and everything you went to get, you couldn't eat it outside or anything like that because just filled your billy can filled up with water straight away, you know. It came down and you never seemed to be dry.
And this is during the monsoon, isn't it?
Well, during the rainy season out there, you know. You never felt dry. You know what I mean? All the time you had clothes that were damp and wet. Couldn't always dry them on properly on a couple of hours hanging on a line in a tent. It wasn't enough to dry them, sort of, you know. So you just suffered like that. But then there was lots of things like the spraying of DDT and stuff like that. And that's caused a hell of a lot of trouble with the soldiers. I mean, so I've got a mate now, two mates from my branch, and through the DDT and spraying.
Now, what was it for?
Well, they said for diseases out there, they reckon there was a sort of a fever stuff that you could get out there, you know, and you're supposed to keep yourself clean. We had one bloke out of everybody, and he was the bloke who kept himself the cleanest. That snuffed him, with it. But the effect on the bone structure of bodies with this stuff they sprayed you with, I got all his legs and bones and arms all twisted the wrong way. And another chap, Derek, all his feet and all that had gone the wrong way, you know. So he's a disabled sort of thing. But a lot of people, I mean, say, a lot of Korean veterans died up to the age of 40. A lot of them never got over 40.
And you think it was this DDT spray?
Well, it's something that they picked up out of it. But the government, MOD and all that never bothered. It's just like now, you see.
Now, so, anything else? Did you get any leave while you were there? Or
well, you went to Japan for 2 weeks.
What do you remember about
R&R?
That?
R&R. Oh, that was all right, you know. Got a nice hotel, couple of mates.
Where was it in Japan?
In Tokyo.
And what was it like? What do you remember about it?
Well, the Ginza, that was the main high street. But that was all right, because you went there, it was mostly having a look round, drinking at night, having a look round back in the hotel. But the thing was, different things. You went in, you bought a tray of beer, but it wasn't like you have pint glasses in this country. You had little glasses about that big.
About what, 3 inches, four inches?
But when you got them, you paid for them, and also they pinned your name and the hotel and that on you. So if you don't come to, they bung you in a hotel. In a taxi, I mean, and the taxi takes you back to your hotel, and that's where you wake up the next morning. But there wasn't much trouble there. You know, a couple of times, you know, little bits of, with the Australians and American, different people, you know, the regiments that had little arguments and stuff. The general thing you get with forces, you know. You take that as a pinch of salt. But it was very interesting in Japan. Met some nice people and went and see the main thing I remember about the Japan was the hotel keeper, or the owner, was a chap in the Japanese army who was sort of a bloke who used to, I don't know how you could put it, the people who used to fly the kamikaze planes, they had a sort of religion they had to be told and all this kind of. And he was such an interesting bloke, and he said, even then, this was in 1951, he said, a kamikaze pilot, he said, in a plane, is worth the biggest bombs you can ever chuck at you, he said. And I've always wondered why we didn't send kamikaze pilots to the big buildings in America, he said. He said, and they're the most vulnerable places America's got for kamikaze pilots. And it wasn't until 9/11 that it proved that they were. And he said that right back in 1951.
Now, anything else? So you, that was your 2 weeks leave in Tokyo, yes. And you enjoyed that. Now, when you went back, anything else, any more units you were attached to?
No. It was mostly a steady work, you know, either looking after the equipment and tanks and stuff like that. You know.
How were the equipment? I mean, how were the dingoes standing up to Korea?
Oh, they were all right. We had only had one trouble with one bloke. the chap who came in one night, and I sent him out to go and get some boxes of hand grenades. And come back in the dark. He comes charging in and said, Corporal, what's the matter? I said, he said, me dingo's on fire. He runs out with extinguishers that we could get, you know, me and a couple of other bugs, and we're pumping away at this stuff. Because behind the seat on the dingo is the petrol tank. And I said, what did you do with those boxes of hand grenades I told you to pick up? He said, they're still in the dingo. Well, I was the only one still pumping the stuff the others had got. Anyway, we got the fire out. And afterwards, I said to him, how the blooming hell did that fire start in the dingo? He said, well, I pulled up. He said, I heard dripping noise. He said, I struck a match to find out what it was. I said, you bloody idiot. It was from your petrol tank. Anyway, it never blew up, so we saved it, you know.
Any problems with the dingo? That was no sort of mechanical problems?
Nothing that was major, you know, that you had to disregard the thing, I said, because you never had massive fitters places. If anything was really wrong with it, like tanks or anything like that, they were just discarded and left or not done.
So what happened next then?
And a couple of things, and then it was coming up to November.
So you were there a full year?
Yeah. So that coming up to November, I noticed that there was a mad goings on of lorries going up to the front, and I thought, well, we got going to have a major incident. And no, I said, when I checked and said, what the hell? They're all ammunition lorries going up. And it was a day before what we call in England Guy Fawkes Night. Well, there was a Guy Fawkes show of stuff that I've never seen since. I think Alamein, they reckon they had a bombardment, but I don't reckon it was as good as the one that they slung over. Every tank, every gun that was in our area was fired and let off all night, Guy Fawkes Night. The tons of ammo that went over was unbelievable, but that was a sight to be seen. You know, the sky was literally rosy red with stuff fired and exploding. But anyway, that was the Guy Fawkes Night.
And what was that in aid of?
Just Guy Fawkes Night. Everybody had that urge to do something that was British sort of thing, you know. So anyway,